Hello and welcome to the Spike podcast. I'm Fraser Myers and joining me as ever are Spike's deputy editor Tom Slater.
Hello, hello.
And Spike columnist Ella Whelan.
Hi.
Coming up on the show, we'll discuss Boris proroguing Parliament, the lecturer investigated for quoting James Baldwin, and I talk to Michael Schellenberger about the Amazon fires. But before we begin, I'd like to tell you about an exciting event. In October, we'll be doing a special live episode of The Brendan O'Neill Show. Brendan will be joined on stage by Rod Liddell. You will not want to miss this. It's part of an event called Podcast Live, which is on the 5th of October between 2:30 and 3:30 p.m. in London. Tickets are now available at podcastlive.com. There are two types of tickets. You can buy tickets for just The Brendan O'Neill Show, or you can buy an all-day ticket, which includes access to all of the other podcasts at Podcast Live. Whichever ticket you choose, whether it's all day or single show, when you go to podcastlive.com, make sure you click the link below the Brendan O'Neill Show logo, as that's the only way you can guarantee a seat for the show. So that's the Brendan O'Neill Show with Rod Liddell at Podcast Live on the 5th of October. Don't miss it. Now, on with the Spike podcast.
The Queen has given her permission to suspend Parliament.
Suspending Parliament is not acceptable. It's not on.
There will be ample time for MPs to debate the EU, to debate Brexit and all the other issues.
It's dictatorship. I think today will go down in history as the day UK democracy died.
As the Brexit deadline looms, Boris Johnson has prorogued Parliament to limit the time MPs will have to block a no-deal Brexit. Remainer MPs have blasted the move as undemocratic and a constitutional outrage. Opposition leaders Jeremy Corbyn and Joe Swinson demanded to see the Queen to block the prorogation. The EU Parliament's Guy Verhofstadt denounced the move as sinister. Protests were organised outside the Houses of Parliament calling to stop the coup. Tom, are we really in the midst of a coup?
No, is the short answer to that. Now, the first thing to say, of course, is that Boris Johnson proroguing Parliament is a cynical and arguably undemocratic move. The clear intention here is to try to squeeze the parliamentary timetable as we're running up to the October the 31st deadline, make it that little bit more difficult for the remainers in Parliament who seem to just about be getting their acts together, just give them less time in order to either legislate against no deal or to try and topple Johnson in some sort of no confidence vote. That is very much clear, and I think using these kinds of wheezes to try and limit the time that Parliament can sit and discuss things is something that no Brexiteer should support. All that being said, I think it's important to note that this is not the coup, the constitutional outrage that many people are making it out to be. The upshot of most of this is that Parliament will probably have something like four or five fewer days to sit than they would otherwise because they were going to break up for the party conference season. You know, this is not, as people were talking about a while ago, you know, shutting down Parliament for weeks and weeks on end, just running down the clock until no deal. This is something far more mild than that. And I think the kind of over-the-top catastrophism, the talk of tin pot dictatorships and all the rest of it is very much overdone. And frankly, whilst Spite has criticised and will continue to criticise Johnson for this particularly cynical move, I think it's fair to say that it's flushed out the deeply anti-democratic, cynical and hypocritical nature of the other side. You know, yesterday we had all of these Remainer MPs and commentators talking in the language of democracy. You know, you had Joe Swinson saying he was stealing the people's voice. This is a woman who very recently said that even if there was a second referendum and she lost it, she wouldn't accept the outcome of that either. Again, this move has again demonstrated how completely mixed up and unprincipled the Labour Party is. You had Jeremy Corbyn, an alleged Republican, demanding an immediate audience with the Queen to try and convince her to not accept Johnson's instruction to prorogue Parliament. You know, you wonder if the next thing he's going to do is go and talk to the generals to see if they might intervene on his behalf. And the protests from left-wingers and people on the Remain side in general were just absolutely shameless. You know, people were talking about standing up for 100 years of democracy. And I just think if over the past 3 years you said nothing when the unelected House of Lords tried to block Brexit, you said nothing when millionaires launched legal challenges to try to frustrate Brexit, you said nothing as voters, Brexit voters, working class people who were more likely to vote Leave than not, were traduced as idiots and racist and told that they shouldn't have been able to vote in the first place. If you said nothing about that, but getting really upset about Parliament maybe being closed for four or five more days, then to put it lightly, your moral compass is severely screwed up.
Absolutely. Ella,
Yeah, well, I mean, the whole point that everyone's missing in relation to Johnson's move, they're so shocked by it, not because of their concern for democracy, because they think that it's going to stop them from stopping no deal. I think anyone sensible knows that really, I mean, you can't really tell what Johnson's motives are. They could be anything, but I think an educated guess would say that it's about passing a really bad hash version of the withdrawal agreement, perhaps without the backstop. So that's why we're concerned about it. Yeah. Never mind democratic process. Brexiteers should be wary about this because it's Johnson's not doing this on a principled stance to get Brexit. He's doing it to secure the kind of Frankenstein's monster of Theresa May's deal to get the heat off his back, basically. So this is not good for anyone. But as Tom says, the other side has, I mean, just the shameless arrogance and hypocrisy of it is staggering. On Tuesday, when every anti-Brexiteer MP gathered together in Church House to sign the statement in this very dramatic, very performative kind of nature, you had John McDonnell up on stage with this very dramatic lighting across his face, saying that this was a, you know, signing statement, saying this was a democratic outrage, calling it a coup. And then people like Anna Soubry saying, the history books will determine the courage of people like me and people who are ready to... I mean, Soubry continuously talks about the history books. It's like she's desperate to make sure that she's recorded. But the point is the hypocrisy of these people to suggest that they are democratic defenders when what they're doing is, as we all know, trying to stop a democratic vote is outrageous. But also just the kind of the lies at the heart of it. So they pretend that this is all about taking a stance on democracy in the abstract, in this sense. But then if you just take one look at the protests that were outside Parliament yesterday, there was a group of people sat around drinking French wine, eating baguettes and cheese and saying, this is an outrage. It's not about democracy, it's about Brexit. Mm. It's the same old, we're European, great, progressive, and you're backwards. And they see Johnson's very much in that camp. So it's kind of a plague on both your houses situation where you don't want to back Johnson because what he's doing is cynical and is not in the best interests of Brexiteers or Democrats. On the other hand, you just really want to lay into this side who's pretending to be democratic, but in fact is just showing the absolute, the depths of depravity of British politics at the moment, where you just have bare-faced liars trying to claim like they've got the moral high ground.
Well, yeah, exactly. And if anyone is going to be labelled a coup plotter, it surely has to be their side. I mean, we think about not just the Church House declaration this week, but also the talk of installing governments of national unities, all women cabinets to overthrow Brexit. This week, the former head of the civil service, Lord Kirkslade, called on civil servants to consider serving, in quote marks, the country instead of the government. And, you know, all this talk of the national interest and serving the country, of course, means serving the interests of the elites by blocking Brexit and remaining in the European Union. But then there is also, I suppose, there is this escalation of political language. Mm. And you just think sometimes the use of language is so out of control with dictatorships and fascism and hard right.
No, it's ridiculous. And it's really interesting as well how people aren't really recognising their own kind of cognitive dissonance on this issue. I think two things really summed that up for me. One of which was some of the placards which had been printed up and handed out at the protest yesterday said something to the effect of save democracy, stop Brexit, which is an interesting idea. And also the changing attitudes towards the Queen over the day, which was really interesting. Because at first you had this, you know, you had everyone demanding an immediate audience with her, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, Joe Swinson, etc., hoping that she would do something which, you know, people talk about Boris Johnson effectively pulling the Queen into politics by asking her to prorogue Parliament. But the idea that rip up, you know, centuries of precedent whereby she would effectively refuse the instruction of a democratically elected that she would refuse the instruction of her prime minister is absolutely ridiculous. Then later on in the day, abolish the monarchy starts trending. So yeah, there's this kind of really, you know, this democracy is not what they're interested in. Stopping Brexit is really what they're interested in. And I think, again, political language is an important point because when these people use the word democracy, they're using a very specific definition of it, particularly if it's MPs. What they mean is the power that our system gives them if they want to take this liberty to frustrate what even their own voters might have voted for. That's what they mean by democracy. democracy. And, you know, even if, you know, we could get into the whole discussion of, as we have many times in this podcast, about what is the role of MPs in relation to Brexit? Is it, you know, the Payneites versus the Burkeans and all the rest of it? I think all of that's largely irrelevant, given most of these people voted to have the referendum in the first place. But I think there's just something really disingenuous and incredibly insidious, is that they're all operating with this definition of democracy that effectively means we should have the right to do the opposite of what the people want.
Yeah.
They should come clean about this. They should make clear that what they want to do is stop Brexit by any means necessary. And I think anyone, no matter how they voted, should give these people no leeway to make these kinds of arguments, because I don't think they're even convincing the people who are making them.
Well, I think what it highlights is that basically every institution is praised or rejected basically on the basis of whether it serves their interests or not. So, you know, not only as you said, the monarchy was useful in the morning when it could be used to block Brexit, terrible in the afternoon when it's used to prorogue Parliament. We've seen the same with Parliament itself. No Remainer gave two figs about parliamentary sovereignty before the Brexit vote until they realised that it could be instrumentalised against the vote for Brexit. We've seen the way the courts have been brought into blocking Brexit. We've seen the way the Constitution, the idea of the Constitution, is wielded to say that everything, you know, that leads towards Brexit is unconstitutional. But then Remainers are prepared to rip up the Constitution and the parliamentary rulebook to block Brexit. So everything is entirely hypocritical. The view of every institution and move depends on whether it's in the service of blocking Brexit or not.
Exactly. They say, well, we'll do backroom deals and we'll plot to stop it. But then when the backroom deals happen on the other side, they get upset. There was talk this year about refusing to back any of the kind of different other policies in relation to parliamentary procedure, not allowing any spending policies to go through, shutting down Parliament that way, basically not playing fair. All of this stuff happens when it's on their terms, but it's when the other side's terms, when it's trying to benefit Brexit, although, I mean, not a huge amount of parliamentary process at the moment has been trying to benefit Brexit, benefit the withdrawal agreement maybe, then they throw their toys out of the pram. And it's also interesting in relation to language. I mean, I've been just fascinated by this phrase, the People's Parliament, that's being used. It's like,
Well, this is the Church House Declaration.
Yeah, the absurdity. Just even on their terms, the absurdity of using that phrase when what you're doing is so obviously against the people. It's just maths in terms of being against a majority. You cannot use the phrase People's Parliament. But I think the thing that we have to recognise moving forward with how to get out of this is to recognise the quite frightening arrogance that's happening at the moment, because really I think that anti-Brexit parliamentarians feel really emboldened. And that's the worst thing about Johnson's move, is what you wrote in your column this week, Tom. They now have something to rail against, when as before, actually, I think the more that time had gone on and the more that Brexit was being delayed, the more people were being frustrated, their position of either revoking or a second referendum was getting less likely. Now everything is up for grabs, and potentially that's exciting because what we need is change. On the other hand, the arrogance of these anti-Brexit MPs shows that they really are going to stop at nothing to thwart democracy, and that's not something to be taken lightly.
I completely agree with that point, and I think that's one of the things that is so irritating, as you say, about Boris Johnson making this move, because it does hand them the moral high ground. But also at the same time, I think, going back to a point that Ella made at the beginning, Brexiteers who are celebrating this proroguing move need to be very, very careful about what it is that they're supporting here. There's been this assumption that what Boris Johnson is really trying to do is to deliver a clean Brexit, to deliver a no deal in some sort of way. There's very little indication that the very least is not his best case scenario. He's still talking about renegotiating the withdrawal agreement. Number 10 confirmed this week that they are only seeking changes to the backstop, which, as we've said many times on this podcast and on Spite, is only the start of what's wrong with the withdrawal agreement. And it's also quite clear from the letter that Boris Johnson sent that his plan here is to squeeze parliamentary time to try and get some sort of renegotiation sealed at the EU Council on the 17th and 18th of October, and then to effectively do what Theresa May always failed to do, which was try to bounce MPs into backing the withdrawal agreement. So to Brexiteers celebrating proroguing this week, I think they should watch themselves, because they might in effect give away their right to complain tomorrow, when these kind of very cynical, very undemocratic moves might actually be put to the end of thwarting Brexit, but from within Boris's camp rather than from without.
Hi, it's Ella Whelan here. I'd just like to take a break from the show to say thank you for everyone who's been giving us donations. Your generosity really means a lot, and it goes a long way to help Spiked keep going and growing. So to those of you who already give, thanks. And if you're thinking about donating, that's really brilliant. One-offs can go a long way, but what really helps is if you think about giving monthly. Even £5 a month can really help. It's really easy to do. You just head to spiked-online.com, click on the big red donate button and fill in your details. So thanks again, and now let's get back to the show.
A professor at the New School in New York has been investigated for using the N-word in one of her classes. Laurie Sheck, also a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, wasn't racially abusing one of her students. She was quoting the great African-American writer James Baldwin. But a white student immediately protested, saying it was never okay for white people to use the N-word and that the New School's teaching program was altogether too white. After student complaints of discrimination, a formal investigation was launched. Ella, what does this incident tell us about the state of our universities?
Well, it tells us something very serious, that the dominance of the kind of woke culture seems to be having some very serious effects, to the extent to which university professors can be suspended or investigated for carrying out their job, for doing something very proper in relation to racism in this case, which was an intellectual investigation into the nuances of how someone like James Baldwin's writing and thought and ideas had been interpreted. So actually what she was asking was a really important question, which is, why had the 2016 documentary I Am Not Your Negro changed the word nigger to negro, and what was going on there, and what ramifications had did that have for anti-racism? It's a very important discussion.
Because the quote from Baldwin originally used the full-blown N-word. Yeah,
originally used the full-blown N-word. And I mean, just the madness at the fact that this was a white student who didn't just say, I don't think a professor should ever use the N-word, but actually had said, a different professor had told me. So had kind of soaked up this woke, supposedly woke ideology of completely putting context out of the question, completely ignoring the fact that she was in a situation in which she should be listening to her professor and challenging herself and talking about racism, and just making this blind assumption that Laurie Sheck was in fact being racist or discriminatory on a kind of unconscious level. And Aaron Gonzalez wrote a really great column on Spiked for this, where he detailed that this wasn't the only case in which this has happened. Actually, this is happening quite frequently, that a professor in Princeton who used the N-word in a class on hate speech and after students complained, walked out, the course got cancelled, and that a law professor at Emory University was investigated for using the N-word in a discussion of a civil rights case. So, I mean, are we just going to wipe out the fact that the N-word exists, wipe out the fact that exists in a historical context, and are we not allowed in universities to talk about racism anymore? Because that actually seems to me a far more problematic situation than occasionally using an offensive and sensitive word in a context of intellectual investigation.
Another example I stumbled across, which was fascinating, which was just in February, there was another James Baldwin case. So it was at a university in Minnesota where a professor had assigned James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. And there was, again, the N-word was quoted. There was also, he sent around after the seminar, because it got into a discussion about when it isn't appropriate to refer to that word in an academic context, sent around a couple of essays, one of which by Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, nothing too anti-woke in that respect. And again, he was suspended over this. So it's just really fascinating that even if an academic can't even quote a literary work, something's gone very, very wrong here. And I think also the cases that Ella's just outlined from Aaron's piece are very instructive as well, about how if you have this kind of phobia of using certain words, of talking about things in plain language, of even just referring to the details of a civil rights case or whatever it is, despite the fact that these sort of speech policers and these word phobes claim to care so much about racism, and that's really their main concern when they're going about policing language, it actually makes the discussion of these topics, it makes getting to the root of some of these problems much, much harder. And it kind of reminds me of the article that Jeannie Suk wrote, who was a law professor, and raised the point that because of this new culture of offence, because of this new sensitivity culture, you had law students who were having to effectively opt out of classes on things like rape. So the next generation of potentially lawyers who would take on the issue of sexual violence in the law profession, you know, more of these people are effectively rendering themselves incapable of playing their part in helping in this particular social issue, because they can't even begin to discuss it. This case, kind of in tandem with some of the other ones that Aaron brought up, just again brings that point back through to the fore, it feels like.
Yeah, I think that's right. There are these are competing demands actually that students are making, because on the one hand, you know, the curriculum is too white, too Eurocentric. We need to learn more about Black history. We need more Black writers on English courses. But at the same time, if you actually encounter any historical Black writing that actually details racism and, you know, talks about real racism, then you're going to hear the N-word and you're going to hear things that you find offensive. So it's almost an impossible demand for professors to be able to teach this stuff.
It was particularly fascinating as well, the fact that not only was it a white student in this case who complained about this stuff, but during a discussion about James Baldwin, a very acclaimed African-American writer, goes on this tangent about how the curriculum at the new school is too white. And you just think, again, it's this kind of ridiculous situation where you spend so much time talking about what it is and isn't appropriate to say that you don't actually get to the meat of talking about what these people claim to actually be interested in.
And I think, you know, what's kind of worrying is that what people want, people clearly want to hear more about Black history, but they want a kind of sanitized version. And it was really interesting that, you know, while it's great that the case against Laurie Sheck was dropped after the intervention of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, a free speech lobby group, but she basically had no internal help along the way. You know, her faculty union, who you'd expect to stand up for her, said that, well, what she really needed to do was modify her teaching and, you know, be more conciliatory, add trigger warnings, perhaps even change the curriculum so as to avoid causing offence. We can't even go into discussions about race and racism. We're blocked off before we can even begin talking about it.
Exactly, and that's why I think it's really important that the student who reported this and who caused all the fuss was white. I mean, I think it would still have been wrong if the student was Black and had an issue with this, because it would still be a case of free expression and being able to think openly. But the fact that they were white and had a problem with this, it's exactly what you said, Fraser, about wanting to sanitize things. I mean, why are you offended as a white person by the N-word? If it makes you feel uncomfortable, perhaps there's a reason for that. And the desire to sort of sanitize and neutralize something like a class on James Baldwin from a white perspective, I mean, doesn't that ring alarm bells? You know, from a kind of, this is what happens with a huge amount of woke politics, is that it's putting actually the oppressors, in inverted commas, the kind of the virtue signaling white people, center stage, because it's all about me. I'm putting myself up as a kind of whipping myself by complaining, by, you know, saying that I'm such a terrible white person and that the curriculum's too white. And it's all about you. It's all about white person. And I kind of wonder what some of the Black students in that class might have thought about that kind of quite disgusting display of virtue signaling and attention seeking. So at the heart of this, there's also something really quite dark going on, which is the ownership of these kind of discussions and the ownership of this politics by white students who were so desperate to be woke that they're essentially shutting off discussion about important issues for both Black and white students.
You're listening to the Spike podcast. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. If you get this podcast on iTunes, why not give us a rating and a review? It really helps new listeners find the show. The fires in the Amazon rainforest have caused international outrage over the past few weeks. Politicians, celebrities, and the media have warned of an impending apocalypse. They say we're seeing record fires and record deforestation. They say the Amazon is the lungs of the world, that it provides vital oxygen for us to breathe. Our house is on fire, said President Macron at the G7 summit in Biarritz. Only none of this is true. I spoke to environmental writer and founder of Environmental Progress, Michael Schellenberger, to find out more. What you're about to hear is an edited extract of a longer conversation we had, which you can read by going to spiked-online.com. I started off by asking Schellenberger what everyone gets wrong about the Amazon fires.
Mostly everything. I mean, I think the first thing people should understand is that there's been a huge decline in deforestation since its peak in the early 2000s. So the context is we're still, you know, 75 or 80% less than the peak. The other thing is that the deforestation has actually been going up in recent years. It didn't start under this president, But clearly, much of this response from the Western media is a reaction to Bolsonaro, not really just about what's happening on the ground. We've certainly seen much bigger environmental impacts occur in the past with much less media attention. And then the other big issue is just that the Amazon is not the lungs of the world. It doesn't produce 20% of our oxygen. We don't need it for oxygen. You know, those of us that care about the natural environment, which is basically most people, have a lot of reasons why we want to save the Amazon or at least protect a bunch of it. But the idea that we need it for oxygen production is a myth. This is just sort of some basic plant science. You know, the Amazon uses about as much oxygen as it produces through a process called respiration, which is the process of pulling nutrients out of the soil into the plant and which accompanies photosynthesis. So there's a lot of reasons for it. But I mean, basically, you know, since the 50s and 60s, after conservationists realized that they could get a lot more media attention by telling people that that environmental problems weren't just environmental problems that they should care about because they love the environment, but that they were really problems that threatened apocalypse, the end of the world. They've been doing this with basically every problem. And honestly, I find it sort of both, it's manipulative and offensive, and I think it's sort of sad, a sad commentary on the cynicism of many environmentalists, many environmental scientists, you know, who think that really they can't get people to care about nature and they only care about themselves.
What's the danger in exaggerating the Amazon fires?
Well, the big one is happening right now, which is that the president, for public relations needs, felt the need to send the military in. you know, which, as one of my sources points out, it frames the problem as though it's a problem of illegal activity. There's a picture that gets presented of these fires are being created by sort of vandals and criminals from sort of outside the forest. You know, 30 million people live in the Amazon. You know, the extent to which Western media and environmentalists ever point to the people living in the Amazon, they always end up pointing to the indigenous people. But the indigenous people are just 1 million of the 30 million people in the Amazon. You know, there's just a lot of normal Brazilian, you know, descendants of slaves, mixed race people who are trying to make a living there. And they're not all good. They're not all bad. They're people that are developing the area in the same way that the Europeans developed Europe and the Americans developed the United States. And, you know, if we want to protect more of the natural environment, we're going to have to work with those people, not vilify and demonize them.
What do you think is motivating the alarmism, especially coming from Western leaders like President Macron?
I think there's something else going on there, which is that there truly is a effort to represent national European interests, economic interests over Brazilian interests. So, I mean, I think one of the most interesting things I discovered in my reporting on the Amazon is that Macron's own farmers, he did a lot of resistance to the deal between the EU and Brazil to import a lot of Brazilian food. That makes total sense when you think about it. So, you know, Macron sort of seems like he's doing something that might allow him to not engage in this free trade deal with Brazil. And maybe he should. I mean, I'm not some, like, rah-rah, everything has to be free trade. You know, I think free trade has been great for, you know, I think trade has been great for Brazil in many ways. It's obviously had some negative consequences, but I do think, you know, it's the stuff that you guys are so good about. It's the moralizing in service of an immoral agenda, or I should say the moralizing in service of a self-interested agenda, you know, because I think that I think what's unethical about moralizing is the ways in which it's a strategy to hide one's self-interest behind altruism. And I think that's really problematic.
Do you think that other environmental issues are used in this same way?
Oh, of course. The two big environmental issues, climate change and deforestation, in both of them you have the rich world saying to the developing world, oh yeah, you know how we developed through deforestation and fossil fuel consumption? You're going to not be able to do either of those. Oh yeah, it just so happens that that we have science to show why you have to stay poor, right? I mean, what a scam, right? Like, I mean, I'm fascinated by you guys, and I think we're similar in the sense that we're post-Marxists, right? We're post-socialists, so you still retain the hermeneutics of suspicion, where when somebody's out there talking about how to make the world a better place and why we all have to do this stuff together, it's worth asking yourself whether that's something that they're really advocating or whether they're really advocating a kind of control or a kind of power move, that there's a hidden agenda there or not so hidden, that's being dressed up as altruism. The real climate hoax is not that climate change isn't happening. That's ridiculous. Of course there's climate change. The real hoax is the ways in which climate change has been used to advance an agenda by rich nations, really to keep developing nations down, to deprive them of resources, to thwart their competitiveness internationally. Not a conspiracy, just a natural outcome of powerful countries acting on their self-interest and doing so in ways that you can talk about in polite company without sounding like you're an oppressive colonialist.
Thank you for listening to the Spike podcast. We'll be back next week. And in the meantime, for more great Spike content or to make a donation, just visit spiked-online.com.